Ezra Sherman.
And I'm Autumn Stoche.
From Eve's Cidery in Vinette, New York. You're listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode 91. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Aria Wincoller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade all around the world. And this week, we're going to be back at a cidery that we were speaking to only last week on episode 90, where Autumn Stoshek, Ezra Sherman, and podcaster Alex Crow was recording a conversation up in the orchard. That was all about organic orcharding, soils, you name it. I mean, Autumn Stoshek is what I consider an American cider maker on fire. And if you haven't heard her talk in that chat, well, you are missing something. So I really, really encourage you to go back and get that chat downloaded on your player, wherever and however you listen to this podcast. That was fantastic. And this chat overall was so great and had two different areas, one up in the orchard and one down the cider house, that we decided to split it up. So if you got a lot out of last week, you're going to get even more this week, I assure you. So if you haven't gotten your cup ready and your cider poured yet, well, this would be a good time. In a moment, I'll be back, and we're going to first welcome some of the folks who have just joined the Cider Chat Facebook page, and then we'll be going right back to Eve's Cidery in upstate New York. Good hello and good day to Simon, who is based in the UK, more specifically in London. And Simon is connected with the Hawks Cidery and a Tap Room. Yes, that is a cider bar. And their little byline is, visit the Hawks Cidery and Tap Room and play your part in the cider revolution. Woohoo! Cider revolution. That's the kind of revolution I don't mind being part of. Any other ones that have projectiles, not so much. But if they're like apples dropping from the trees and pears, that is my kind of revolution. I think it's your kind of revolution too, isn't it? In Ciderville, we just want to be the folks who are sitting around in our chairs, raising a glass and laughing our asses off. Yes, that is a good cider revolution. I like that. Then there's also Lou, who is from Texas, and Lou reached out to me just kind of asking some questions on the Cider Chat Facebook page, and that was nice to connect there. He found Cider Chat via iTunes when he did a search, so that was great. He didn't know about Cider Chat any other way except doing a search. That just tells you, every day I meet people who have no idea that there is a conversation online in Ciderville on this here podcast. So that's another call to all of us to not only grab your glass, but grab your friend's phone and say, hey, do you know about this podcast? We're having a blast. Check it out. Subscribe today. Yep. So welcome, Lou. And then there's Nathaniel, and I'm not sure where Nathaniel is, but it looks like he's part of the military, maybe a flyer. So that must be super cool. I always want to learn how to fly a plane. And then there is Clariston from, I'm sorry if I mispronounce your name, but it looks like you are also from the UK. So that's great. And then there is also Darren. Darren is way out there in Ciderville somewhere doing good stuff, I'm sure. And a big shout out to Rick, who is the founder and maker at Newtopia Cider in San Diego. If you don't know too much about the scene in San Diego, it is really starting to kick into gear for cider. In fact, this isn't necessarily San Diego. LA is north of San Diego, probably by 2 or 3 hours if you're hitting the traffic, even worse. But what an amazing area. And, you know, I've been out to that region quite a bit. And in San Diego proper, for libations, it is insane. You got to go there. It's so easy to get off of the San Diego airport, which is lovely. It's right in the harbor. And you could cruise around into the city via Uber, like a 10-minute ride, and check out Newtopia. So that's great. Best of luck with that, Rick. There's going to be some more cideries popping up in that area, too. And I can't say enough about that San Diego airport. I mean, you're right north of the border of Mexico, so that's a good landing point if you're going to go south into Baja, which I highly recommend. But if you're just hanging around San Diego proper, wow, there's many a nights where I've hung out way into the evening and got the red eye home to the East Coast and just hung out the last couple hours and minutes on the West Coast, just sitting out on the beach, and then it was a quick pop over to the airport. Love those kind of airport landings, arrivals and departures. And I'd like to also then move on to, we're going to go to say hi to Rocky, who is from Alabama. So that's cool. Making cider down there in Alabama, I hope. And now we're going to jump to the other side of the pond across the Atlantic and go to the Netherlands and say, hoe had it, met u? Met u? Met me? I'm messing it up. I'm messing up my Dutch. I'm going to try that again. I want to say hello to Frans. You know, I'm actually gearing up to go to the Netherlands. I'll be going there at the end of September, and I'll talk more about that trip in some more upcoming episodes. But Frans, welcome. Your whole scene over there in the Netherlands is really cranking, isn't it, Insider? Super exciting, because I know how well the Dutch can do agriculture, so orchard care is definitely something that I suspect it's going to be getting more and more popular for the Dutch. Then there's also a Tess who is from New York, and it looks like Tess works with the Boston Beer Company. And Boston Beer Company is based in, well, Boston proper, of course. It's actually really more like Ohio, too. You know, that's Sam Adams, and that is also the company that owns Angry Orchard. So I have lots of good feelings, actually, for the Boston Beer Company, having been a beer writer for many years. And Angry Orchard gets a lot of crap from folks being a big corporate cider maker. But you got to know the backstory there, folks. They have actually been, well, Jim Koch, who started it, you know, way before the Angry Orchard label came on, there was a push there to get cider going. And I happen to be judging some of the ciders early on when they were testing the market. I was judging that down in Rhode Island, and it had come through, and we'd only have like maybe like 2 ciders, and they'd both be from Angry Orchard. And that was amazing. They also brought in an amazing guy, Alan Tringham, who used to be a cider maker at Bulmers way back when. He's departed. He's no longer with us. But, you know, it's always easy to beat up the big guy, but they took a long way getting there. And the fact that the Boston Beer Company didn't just stay beer focused, but knew that cider was important, I think has really benefited us all, because, well, heck, you know, don't they get the word out there about cider? As most folks who have no concept about cider, at least they know Angry Orchard. And that's a stepping stone. It's all about stepping stones. So cool stuff. Thanks for joining the Facebook page, Tess, and best of luck with all you folks there at the Boston Beer Company. And then we have Tanya, who is somewhere out there in the world. Welcome. And then Rita, who is based in the UK, but she is the editor of Cider from Poland. And that's a Facebook page. They have a website, and you can find everything you want to know about Polish cider. So you might want to check out their Facebook page, too. So a nice little collection of people all over the map. And know that the Cider Chat Facebook page is non-exclusive. You can join, too. And I hope to see you there soon. We're going to next head into the main chat with Eve's Cidery. And allow me to give you a little bit of an idea of where it is actually located. New York certainly hits Long Island Sound. Then it goes northward and to the west. And the western point is like Buffalo and certainly Niagara Falls. And then you could kind of go over the border into Canada. Lake Erie is right next to Buffalo and goes down along the shore there. Beautiful, beautiful region. I have worked out in western New York. I've only been through the area that Eve's Cidery is, really, only once that I could actually recall. So if you have Buffalo to the west and Lake Erie, and you head now to the east, there is a region called the Finger Lakes region of New York. And these are actually really long lakes. If you look at them on the map, it looks kind of like fingers. I'm not sure in total how many they really consider are there. Just taking a quick look at the map, it's at least seven. And there's a couple main ones that are the largest ones of them all. But it's such a fantastical area to be in because it's filled with wineries and, of course, all this fresh water. Really recreation rich area. So Eves is right at the south end of the Finger Lakes, just above the border of Pennsylvania. A little south of there would be like Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and Scranton. I have worked out in that area a little bit. I haven't been necessarily in the Finger Lakes region for quite a while, but I just recall it being super, super beautiful. So I imagine it's fantastic area to grow apples, and that's what they're doing there, big time. So again, check out that first episode, part one, which is episode 90. And now we're all going to grab a glass and join this chat that was recorded with Alex Crow at Eve's Cidery with Ezra Sherman and Autumn Stoshek.
You do a lot of champagne method ciders.
That's right. That's all that we do for creating bubbles. Uh-huh. We don't do any forced carbonating.
What was sort of the impetus behind choosing that?
Well, Autumn was making cider before I thought about making cider. And the champagne method was already what she used. The champagne method to me seems like straightforward and easy from a methodology standpoint. Mm-hmm. From a physical labor standpoint, it's intimidating.
Yeah.
Maybe. You know, it's like conceptually seems very straightforward because you're basically, you know, doing another fermentation, except to the vessel as a bottle. And then the disgorging process, once you get the technique down, is also, I don't know, it's doable. The forced carbonation route, you also need another piece of equipment, which is expensive, which we couldn't afford for like many years, which is a bright tank. And you know what that is. It's like, you know, a vessel that can take a lot of pressure that you just push the CO2 into through a carbonating stone. If you're focusing on the bubbles, or if the bubbles are an important aspect of the product, the bubbles are higher quality with the champagne method. They're really small and elegant, and they kind of elevate the aromas, kind of like after you pour the cider into a wine glass. They're very nice vehicle for transporting like the aromas up and towards you, and they're very long lasting, the bubbles. I mean, we'll like fail to clean up after a meal or something, and the bottle will still be bubbly like the next day.
Do you have any sort of special riddling or disgorging techniques that you use?
We don't do riddling because we use a yeast that's encapsulated in like a little alginate bead, which allows the yeast to kind of fall right to the mouth like in less than a minute and not stick to the glass. The disgorging method, I don't know who invented it, but it's a departure from using the method of like freezing the necks. and having some apparatus that...
So you're not chilling them before?
We do chill it.
Okay.
And that makes a big difference in how volatile kind of the pop is.
But just chilling it to the point that it limits the amount of gushing.
Exactly.
You're not freezing the necks.
Right. So we're just putting it like down to refrigerator temperature or whatever our cooler can manage, frankly.
35 degrees.
Ideally, we've done it a lot warmer. But 35 is nice, mm-hmm. if you can get it down that cold. And then we just pop the closure when it's like at maybe 60 degrees angle. It's almost vertical. And there's just like enough pressure to keep the yeast elevated after you flip it up. And like kind of enough gravity, I guess, to kind of help you keep the cider in the bottle below the yeast.
It's a real art.
Yeah.
Like, if you watch Ezra do it, he just gorgeous because he loses the least amount of cider.
Uh-huh.
He loses about 15 mils per bottle. But if you see him, he's just got this garbage bag on his head. And, the bottles are upside down in these crates and they're chilled. And he's just going.
You gotta be,
get a rhythm going.
Just it looks really easy.
It sounds like you've got the technique down. Let's say you're someone who's never tried it before.
Okay.
What do you recommend in terms of like how do you approach it?
Okay. Number one, you've got to have a really good bottle opener.
Mm-hmm. So the opener's important. You can't just use any old opener.
Right. And
nice.
This is the king size two way. Edlin Company Incorporated USA. Anyways, it's a super robust beer bottle opener. You want one that you can like hold in your hand, and you want one that really grabs the crown cap. And then you want to, I'm right-handed, so I cradle the bottle like in my left arm, and I put the beer on cap or whatever on the crown cap and seat it there. So it's you could uncap it right there in the horizontal position. And then so I've got it cradled in my left forearm. And then I just tip it up to like 60 degrees. And you have the opener, hanging on there. And then you pop it and clear the cap away, mm-hmm. as you unpop it. When you tilt it up, you don't want to be jerking it.
The thing is, I just have to clarify something because I'm imagining your listeners trying to imagine this. He's saying 60 degrees, but he is not, like...
I
don't know if that's right. Like, don't go out and, like, look in the mirror and think 60 degrees.
Don't get your protractor
out. You might have to, like... Yeah, I'm trying to remember if there's a video up on our website still of Ezra disgorging. He knows by feel where that bottle is, and that's the critical piece. Mm-hmm. Not too soon, not after. You do it too soon, you lose too much liquid. Afterward, the yeast won't come out. It just falls down.
I tell you what, the mistake most people make is shooting it off too early because you just get nervous that the yeast is going to fall back down. I would err on the side of doing it late. You almost always are fine doing it late in your mind. But that I would tell people if they're going to do it, just like tilt it up and count to
I'll
one.
I'll have him put that video up for your podcast.
Yeah, that would be great.
The old one.
I'm sure
really
people would love
old,
to see it.
But
oh, okay.
But that would be, it would mesh well with this because then you could go look at that.
Yeah, we'll link to it. Oh, yeah. So I'm curious. Is this your press?
Yeah.
So obviously it's like a rack and cloth.
Yep, it's old-fashioned, Owasco Orchard Equipment Supply Company, rack and cloth press, 32-inch. It's, I bought it really 2004. At that time, like New York and Pennsylvania were just putting in all of these regulations. Like suddenly we're like, now you have to get a $15,000 UV pasteurizer or whatever. People just were giving it up. So I got it for an amazingly cheap price.
I love that.
Yeah.
How much did you get it for?
$2,500.
Nice. Is that plus with the grinder?
Oh, wow.
And like
the elevator?
The whole thing. Yep, the whole thing. All the motors.
Motors weigh like 80 pounds a piece.
Two sets of press claws. Two sets of racks.
One set I left in the laundromat when our dog
was born.
That's a whole story.
And the homeless people stole them from blankets.
Oh, man.
13 press claws.
Oh.
Worth $100 a piece.
Yeah.
That
utility value was
I know, like, it was not particularly good.
None. They weigh, like, 5 pounds apiece.
One of the things that I notice is you do a lot of things that might be considered more labor-intensive, you know?
Thank you.
Yeah, but...
That's, like, exactly our shtick.
Why is that?
Well, what things?
Well, so, like, I, you know, there's probably... Like, someone might use a bladder press now instead of rack and cloth. Is there a reason specifically why you want to use
rack
that?
Rack and cloth press makes the highest quality juice plus the highest quality, the highest efficiency yields. It's really a lot of work to set it up and clean it. There's, like, that's probably the biggest downside of it. And... unlike right like a squeeze box or something, it's not like a continual pressing system, so but I don't think you can beat the juice. I really don't.
So it's the highest quality you can get, and you got it for a song, so that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, everything you see about this cidery represents, like, basically 1 year at a time, one step at a time, you know, buying one more tank, one, you know, there was never like the $1 million investment here, so it's that's determined a lot of what we do is just really kind of, you know, who we are and what we could afford.
Mm-hmm.
So how long have you been collecting pieces?
16 years. Yeah, 16 years.
We've been here like 10 years.
And yeah. Like the champagne method is sort of another, some might consider it more labor intensive, but I guess you don't have to buy a bright tank. And it produces a better quality of
bubble.
So we don't, so like some people feel like cider is inherently sparkling. I run into that constantly. Like even with people who like know about wine.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess if you think that cider is inherently bubbly, the difference between champagne method and forced carbonation isn't that great.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe that. Like, I probably 50% of the cider I drink is still. I really love still cider. I don't always want to have bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to have bubbles, I want to have champagne.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't drink soda. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, I think, the, it's an aesthetic thing.
Yeah.
More than anything else. If you're going to do that, then if you're going to have the bubbles, you're going to have the wonderful bubbles. You have the beautiful bubbles, you know? And one of the things
I'm just
that...
thinking about Steve Wood listening to this. I put my input there.
I've been trying for years to get him to do the champagne method. No, I'm just kidding.
he's like, your cider is great, except that you...
Wow.
We love their cider.
But I love his, and he should make more still cider.
It's just awesome. His cider's freaking great.
But this is a really interesting thing about like labor intensivity. When we look at like our business as a whole, and we look at like what is the cost of like one of our bottles, and we look at like, you know, our like, so like we don't like have this business to be business owners and hire a cider maker and hire an orchard maker and hire pickers. Like, this is our job, this is what we do. We're working class people. We don't mind working, we don't mind doing stuff. From a business perspective, the cost of the labor, and granted, like, we don't make a lot of money, but you know, we pay $15 an hour. That's kind of like the standard for our business. That is nothing compared to the cost of marketing our product, or the cut that the distributor takes. When somebody goes to the store and they buy like our champagne method cider, and it's amazing because it's made with a champagne method, like, they're getting such a great deal, it's unbelievable. So that's kind of something that's always bothered me about like the cider industry generally, which is like, you got to put so much into marketing and packaging that the raw product and like the physical process of making it, everyone's trying to squeeze that.
Do you have any tips for other cider makers, perhaps aspiring or even experienced?
One thing that I think is really a really, really, like, probably the maybe third biggest part of cider making is like developing your own palate. So I think it's really, important to, number one, ground yourself in like European cider traditions, so you have this kind of historical cultural background on cider. Number two, train yourself on common winemaking faults and flaws, because I think sometimes people can get really confused about what they're doing if they don't understand that that flavors like come is like a microbiological flaw as opposed to like that it's actually coming from the fruit or something like that.
Like what would be a common thing that you think people might run into
for like home cider making?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Probably some of the more common things that we encounter in people's ciders are like sort of like gross wild malolactic fermentations that are resulting in mouse or you know, just generally like unpleasant flavors. Another common flaw that we find in ciders is oxidization.
And how does that manifest? Like how can you tell a cider is oxidized?
That's a good question. So like something that smells like cooked, like Mott's apple juice. Like Mott's apple juice smells, like canned apple juice is like a very oxidized apple juice smell, I think.
And how does that happen?
That's just going to be from careless exposure to oxygen.
So not keeping your fermenter totally sealed up, like maybe...
After the fermentation's complete.
After the fermentation.
Yeah. The Autumn had kind of, when we taught a class, she had kind of a... You had some, like, five basic rules, right, for home cider making, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Remember that?
And so, what were they?
I think one was not having too aggressive a fermentation. It's keeping the... temperature down in the environment, keeping it in a cooler place, maybe, you know, like 60 degrees. Or,
60 degrees, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Monitoring the fermentation.
Yeah, and, so, right. So that's true. Like, I think one of the biggest mistakes that people make going into cider making is just sort of thinking that it's like something... Well, like, not understanding that it's an extremely fragile and constantly changing product and thinking that they have, like, years to do it or something, or, like, a year to do it or something like that, and that they can just, like, put it in their basement and, like, check it out, like, a couple months later or something like that. So, like kind of my advice is you need to, like, throughout the entire primary fermentation, be watching it all the time. You need to know that the moment the primary fermentation stops, and at that point, if you can make it cold, like that's like the very best possible thing you can do.
And when you say make it cold, you're talking about
as cold
like refrigeration.
As you can. Okay. Yeah. Like if you pressed it in the fall and it fermented and it's now December and you have like a mud room or something, you don't want it to freeze, but if you can have it at 35 degrees, that would be awesome. But 40 is better than 60.
And so that's just to age it?
No. Well, that's just because... Okay, so there's an alcoholic fermentation. But then there's all these other fermentations that want to happen. Brettanomyces wants to live. The cider is almost entirely malic acid. And so it's immediately wants to go into malolactic fermentation. It's almost like the course of nature. So, and that all of those things live in a warmer environment.
Mm-hmm.
So, including your Saccharomyces yeast, but if they can do their thing and then you can, cool it down. That's like a really great tool that a home winemaker has to just, have like a lot better success.
Then control your temperatures.
Well, get your primary fermentation
and monitor.
And immediately make it cold.
Yeah.
Let it settle out.
And so,
and bottle it quickly.
Rack it and bottle it and drink it.
I think there's also this perception that when you're doing your primary fermentation that you should be gluing air, keeping your fermenter totally sealed up. So how do you monitor it? You know, what's the risk?
I don't get it.
No.
Don't you have a
Actually, that's not true. Uh-huh. That is a fallacy.
Okay.
Sorry. You need to be really, really, really careful about oxygen exposure once the alcoholic fermentation is complete and you don't have the protection of dissolved CO2 or the lees. So yeast actually need oxygen. And one of the other most common flaws that I see in cider is problems with hydrogen sulfide and their, you know, the things that they evolve into, like mercaptans and disulfides. So
that's the rotten egg sort of smell is one of them. There's like
matches,
meat,
rotten eggs,
sulfur,
rotten cabbage, yeah. Burnt rubber, like when it's, you know, really old. So and that's happens when the yeast are stressed, and one of the biggest reasons yeast get stressed is because they don't have enough air.
Mm-hmm. So aeration is like not something you need to do at the beginning, like because you know a lot of home brewers aerate their wort before they start the fermentation. But like generally speaking, you pour your cider into the bucket, there's going to be enough dissolved oxygen into
probably.
It.
Probably. But if during the course of your fermentation you're smelling like a farty smell and it doesn't go away after a couple of days, definitely like you know, transferring it to another container to like mix it with air can often really like do wonders for that. So.
And so.
And yeah, lifting the bong out of it and smelling is not going to hardly let any air in it at all. Now, conversely, another huge flaw that I see a lot is acetaldehyde, which is most commonly, I think, a result of a film yeast. And that is from oxygen exposure and warmer temperatures. That's after the fermentation. And so that's where, actually, if that carboy is sitting around at room temperature and there's no more dissolved CO2 and you're not keeping it stirred up with the lees, then lifting the bung off the carboy is actually a bad thing. Uh-huh. And you should, you know, put a blanket of nitrogen on it or something like that.
So that's actually something I've not heard too many people talk about, is stirring the lees. What are you doing when you do that?
Well, the lees offer oxygen protection. So it, in our case, it enables us to have a longer maturation period without adding sulfites. To basically be able to hold on to the cider and allow for some maturing and some micro-oxygenation and stuff like that.
So how often are you doing, like, after the primary fermentation?
We don't do it, like, every day. Yeah. We're not trying to, like, get, like, a bunch of yeast autolysis and stuff, but we're just using it as an antioxidant, essentially. So we'll do it maybe once a month, something like that.
And then you would say age it for how long?
Well, let me give you an example. We are just blending and bottling our 2016 ciders. So that would be from our primaries took a long, 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 long time too. They were probably, I mean, they've been on the lees, obviously, throughout the entire fermentation. Mm-hmm. But maturing for maybe 6 months, something like that.
I think that's another thing that people who come from a home brewing background, I think that's a common thing, is they want to get the fermented liquid off of the lees as soon as possible. But you're saying, because they're worried about the autolysis and
for a flavor,
for off flavors or something,
right.
Or whatever flavor that.
If you have off flavors in your lees, you should rack your cider off the lees for sure. It only works if you have healthy lees.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good distinction to make. Interesting. Okay. Those are good tips. Is there anything else that comes to mind? Was that 2 of 5, 3 of 5 rules? Or is there anything else?
I guess the other thing I would say is cider isn't, it's not just like inherently stable. So, like, I think sometimes homebrewers don't understand that the cider they're buying in the store that's on a store shelf at room temperature has been preserved in some way that they themselves don't have access to. Like, as a home brewer, you don't have a sterile filtration setup, or you're not pasteurizing. So if you can bottle it, like if you're bottling it still, if you can bottle it and put it in your fridge, your cider is going to be so much more impressive than if you keep it in your cellar. It's like just a simple little thing, but it, you know, it's a lie. And people, I hear people justifying skanky cider by saying, you know, what do you think people, like, this is how people drank cider, you know, like in colonial America. And yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm guessing it probably, maybe cider was rougher for sure. But another thing is that people didn't have this like bizarre expectation that we have now, that everything is just like, we can have it whenever we want and it lasts forever. Like people, like cider, it, living cider like that is a seasonal thing. Mm-hmm. You know, homebrew cider, that's a seasonal thing. You make it, you finish the fermentation in December, you let it, you know, settle out and mature during the cold winter months, you bottle it up in April and you drink it in the next couple of months. Maybe you make some of it into champagne that lasts longer, but it's not like, you know, you just have it hanging around in your apartment for 9 months and you're going to expect that it's going to taste as good. It's just simple. Uh-huh. If you're homebrewing and you don't have a way to stabilize the cider, you just have to understand that it's not, it's like an inherently, it's inherently evolving and devolving. Mm-hmm.
And the way that people would stabilize it maybe with sulfites is not going to do the same thing.
So.
Yeah,
but I mean, you have to put, if sulfites are going to cause microbiological stability for you, like alone without another technique, it's all you're going to taste. You know, the rate you would have to put them at is so high.
You put some a bit in to control like oxidation, but the other way to stabilize it is sterile filtration or pasteurization.
Right, so sulfites aren't a long-term preservative
Don't get me wrong. That's not the only other way to, like, there are more, there's many different ways. It's very nuanced. Like, stabilization is really nuanced. I think I was just making the point that I'll often taste cider from homebrewers where I'm thinking, I bet this was good when they first made it, mm-hmm. but they just kept it around and, you know, I just noticed that people don't understand that it just changes and it, mm-hmm. and it's got living things in it and it doesn't get better if those things are growing too.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, one of the things is, you know, like whether you're doing keeving or you're doing multiple rackings or you're starting out with organic fruit that has extremely low nitrogen and you're not adding any nutrients to your fermentations, having very, very, very low levels of nutrients in your cider makes it a lot more stable. Another thing that makes cider a lot more stable is having really high acidity. Mm-hmm. You know, depending on what your, you know, what the kind of flavor profile that you like, it is true, like without a doubt, that the higher acidity that you get in the cider, the more stable it's going to be, for sure. And alcohol. Uh-huh. I mean, that's another thing is using high Brix apples and having higher alcohol content, you mm-hmm. know, you're going to get a more stable cider that way as well.
What all ciders are you currently, I mean, do you make a still cider? How many of the ciders are still that you make? Is that a,
well, we've made two still ciders, right? We've made a Kingston Black, which is our single variety still cider. And we have made, a blend, which we call Albee Hill for a number of years. And still cider is kind of what we drink a lot of.
Do you find a lot of people are into it, or is it like you have
to serve
more?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we originally made the Albee Hill as like just kind of a cider. We made it for ourselves, like as the cider that we wanted to drink. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like always what it's been, is this sort of like, when we sit down and we look at the ciders we have from the vintage and we think about our blends, it's always like, okay, and which one do I want to drink? You know, that's what the Albee Hill sort of becomes. It's mostly our estate grown fruit from Albee Hill, but sometimes, you know, there's a small amount of other stuff in it. But it's when we sat, we were sitting down to look at kind of, you know, the blending, the blending and how we allocate the blends and the different ciders we make is a big sort of artistic endeavor, but it's infused with, you know, the reality of like what we're selling and maybe anticipating what we'll sell next year and thinking about how to use the cider that we made and so on and so forth. And we sat down this year to think about what our blends were going to be. And we looked back over our sales and it's sort of mind-boggling how much of the Obi Hill we sold this year. And that's from, you know, maybe when we first started making it like 6 years ago, something like that, when it was like selling, oh, like here's like the cider that we love that we sold, you know, we worked really hard to sell like 80 cases of or something like that. So that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's, people are coming around to a still cider. Yeah.
Well, I think like the wine drinkers, to them, it's the most approachable.
It translates from their wine.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You're right. Wine drinkers who like dry wine and have like a good palate, to them it's
easier to make the leap into cider.
Exactly.
Right now we have, well, we make the Perry when we have the pears, and then we have the Northern Spy, which is our other single varietal cider. And then we have the Autumn's Gold, which is a blend that is really heavy on English bittersweets. We have the Darling Creek, which is sort of off dry and has a lot more acidity, but is also like tannic and made with a lot of bittersweet and bitter sharp fruit. What else do we make?
Well, we make an ice cider.
Make ice cider. Right now, we're really excited because our orchard is like maturing, and a lot of varieties that we had been like had like one or two trees of and then planted some more of and then waited 5 years for them to grow have a big crop this year. Mm-hmm. So we have this really exciting opportunity this year to be doing
presses of
a lot, yeah, a lot more things that we've never even had in 16 years.
2018 maybe, or
well, I don't know if we'll blend them or not, but we'll at least be able to
evaluate them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not like, yeah, so we make seven different ciders, but we're evolving all the time, and we may drop some of those blends and make different. I don't know. We'll see.
Cool. And you don't have a tasting room here. Probably just because you're kind of off the beaten path, like you're not like on a wine trail, or is that like a deliberate decision, or is it
probably
is
both
thinking about doing it, or what's the situation there?
So we are located near the Finger Lakes, and I think when I first started the business, and then for a long time, both Ezra and I really felt like looking at the Finger Lakes winery model, like the only way that you can financially survive as a small beverage producer, farmer, is to have a tasting room. And that was like always in our minds, like we have to do that. And we,
it seemed like a,
it's like the,
it was an ego trip. It seemed like a real, sign of success to be able to attract people to your place and have them walk in and like taste.
And that's how you sell it.
Room.
I mean, how
you're
else,
a destination.
And how else do you sell it? I mean, I think that's sort of the looming question for any business: is how do you sell it? And here in the Finger Lakes, we have that model. People come here; they come. It's a tourist destination. Mm-hmm. People go and they visit the wineries and they pay for tastings and they buy wine there, or you know, perhaps cider. But when we had our kids, like we just like kind of had this total total reevaluation of like who we were and what our priorities were and like how we wanted to live our lives. And I think one of the things that we realize is that we want to focus on what we want to do. And the main thing that we want to do is grow apples and turn them into cider. And so I guess this is backwards. The secondary thing we want to do is to actually make a living doing that, and that's definitely the challenge. So some people subsidize that activity by running a retail business, and that's a tasting room. Mm-hmm. And that's a business model here in the Finger Lakes. And some people do that by having a large business that has a lot of volume and can support the kind of marketing efforts that you need to do to create pull-through in a wholesale market and on the lower margins that you get when you have a distributor. We're still trying to understand if there's a way to, I guess, be small, not have a retail business.
Mm-hmm. And not have an outside job. And
not have an outside job and not have like 90% of the cost of your cider be marketing.
I guess I'll just say it was really a pleasure to walk through your orchard and get to see everything. And I really appreciate talking to you guys. It's just been...
We really enjoyed it too.
Good. Thank you so much. Is there any sort of like parting words of wisdom you'd like to send out to everyone?
Since I'm like on a roll here with like the future of cider, I can't say enough that I think, you know, it's a really exciting but scary time in sort of the evolution of cider in this country. So we haven't been at it forever, but 16 years is a while, and we've seen a lot of changes. And cider is exciting, but here's the thing. Like, for cider to really take hold in this country, it has to be something that's more than the next new thing. It's got to be something that people drink regularly, that they stock their pantry with, that's part of their food traditions, that's part of their food culture. And so I think that's just like the parting note I'd like to leave everybody with, is like, what does that mean, and what does that take, and how do we create that? Because it's easy to get excited about the next new thing, but the next new thing is not going to be cider, because mm-hmm. it's been cider. And our challenge now is to create a long and sustaining food culture that's based around cider here in this country.
Let's make it a regular thing.
A regular thing.
Yeah. That's it for part two of our chat with Eve Cidery. To see the video of Ezra disgorging, which I gotta say is pretty spectacular as well as informative, head on over to the show notes for this episode, or you can go over to evecidery.com/ciderchat. Thanks again to Autumn and Ezra for sharing all of their knowledge with us out here in Ciderville. This is Alex Crow. Thanks for listening.
Are you thirsty yet for a bottle of Eve Cider? Well, now is the time to order, because for the month of August, specifically for listeners of Cider Chat, they are offering free shipping. So do go to that link that Alex mentioned. It is evescider.com/ciderchat, or go to the show notes for this here episode number 91 at ciderchat.com, and you could click on the link right there. You won't necessarily find it on their website, so you really have to either do what we just said, evescider.com/ciderchat, or go to the show notes for episode number 91. One of the techniques mentioned on this week's chat was where you leave the cider on the lees, and that is really called the technique of batonnage. And you stir it in, and there's all different kinds of things you can see online and on YouTube where people have set up pretty elaborate barrel rollers where they have the cider in a barrel and they're able to like stir it around by just actually rolling the barrel, which is pretty neat. And I talked about that on both episode 75 with Alan Shapiro and episode 76 with Lou and Sue Chadwick. That one was on grafting too. So there's quite a bit of info, or you can look it up online, do a little YouTube, Google, or just kind of go Wikipedia. But it is spelled B-A-T-T-O-N-N-A-G-E. A-G-E. And this is, again, typically used for white wine making and will work with cider making too. So it's a good little tip there. This particular chat this week, I find, was loaded with excellent tips. And if you want to reverse and go back to that, just kind of earmark on your phone right now or jot down, go to minute 24 and 44 seconds, or another way to say it is just 15 seconds shy of 25 minutes in. And that's where Alex asked about any particular tips. And they gave a flurry of them that were, I think really, really great to etch down and put in your notebook as you're moving into your own cider making, whether you are commercial or non-commercial. Lots of really good value on this episode. So let's take a quick little break here. Be right back. Now, why don't you fill up that glass again and just sit back and enjoy the ride as we cruise along a little bit further into Ciderville.
You gotta grab that luce. You gotta bust that thing. Get your kicks on the street. Gotta kick back, step back. Oh, you gots to skeet. It's a rat-a-tat-a-rat-a-tat-a-rat-a-tat-a-bala. Rat-a-tat-a-rat-a-tat-a-rat-a-tat-a-holla. I don't wanna be pushed like a dude the push. When it comes to the cheddar, keep it under the cushion. I don't wanna be ganked like a dude the gank. When it comes to the cake, be me a thank. I don't wanna be pushed like a dude the push. When it comes to the cheddar, keep it under the cushion. I don't wanna be ganked like a dude the gank. When it comes to the cake, be me a thank.
Well, I had this fun little email come in from a gentleman by the name of Mark Glenock, and I met him at Cider Days a couple of years back. He is from Brittany, France, and he sent out this notification that there's going to be a live on-air tasting, and anyone can join. It's via a Facebook page, and that's facebook.com/AOP Cornoulou. I'm probably not saying that right at all. I'm going to try that. Cornoulou, and that is one of the designated areas that there's an appellation for in France. Like you have Pays d'Auge, Cornoulou, and off the top of my head, I can't think of the third one right now. These are very specific cider making techniques that are used in that area, and then they get a designation that they get to put on their bottles. And on September 22nd, which is a Friday, they're going to have a live tasting between 6 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. So I imagine that's going to be that time in Brittany, which if you're in New York would translate to 12 noon. It's not a bad time to crack open a bottle of cider and enjoy and hear what they're having to say. I'm going to put this posting up on the actual event page on Cider Chat because I need to do a little bit of work on that. I'll do another reminder of this event coming up as we get closer. He said that it'd be really great if you could get yourself a bottle of AOP Cornoulou before the event because it'll allow you to appreciate what is being said here. But any other bottle can do. This tasting is an invitation to appreciate the cider of tradition. So isn't that fun? I love that kind of stuff. And I'm actually going to be back in France a couple days before this event. So I'm not going to actually be able to follow it because the timing is a little off for me and what I'll be doing that day myself. But who knows? Maybe it will open itself up. And I think anything like this where we bring it in at a global concerted focus, it gets cider trending, and what's more fun than that, just being able to drink with some folks over in France. So do look for that on the Cider Chat Facebook page and also on the event page at ciderchat.com. Oh, and I just brought up a Google Translate to see if they can help me pronounce this word. So here we go.
Cornouaille. Cornouaille.
And in English, it's Cornwall. So I was way off and I'm not sure if I could do that. I'm going to have to practice. Wow. Just the flavor of the area when you really kind of mull over a language. And I think it's best done to lubricate your voice with a bit of cider. I think you agree. Konyuai. It doesn't look like that, but that's the way it's pronounced, so go figure. Last week I mentioned that Ramborn Cider in the country of Luxembourg just joined the Cider Going Up campaign at the Cider Chat Patreon page, and that floored me. Because how cool is that? And I got to go back and forth with Addy K and found out that he's going to be at the Seattle Cider Summit coming up on September 8th and 9th. That's an event put on by Alan Shapiro, who I adore and does fantastic festivals. So I imagine Addy and everyone going there is going to have a ton of fun. And that floored me. It was fantastic. Really helping get this podcast going because I'm kind of putting all my time and energy into it. And then lo and behold, I got another notification that Big Fish Cider Company, which is based in Monterey, Virginia, and that is kind of like on the border of West Virginia and not too far from some other cideries. So it sounds like just a heavenly place. And Virginia is, I want to say, a heavenly place. There are good people in Virginia, and Kurt Billingsley is one of them. He is the webpage goes, he describes himself as the cider maker. I want to just note, cider maker, one word, and the chief cider evangelist. So I'm stoked at some point to get Kurt on the podcast because I've been following along on this cidery for quite a while. And I saw that he had gone on an overseas trip to the UK and was posting some magnificent photos there. And then just checking out the website and seeing all the great stuff and the people that are connected to this, you could tell that there's a lot of passion for the cider. And at some point, we are going to have Big Fish Cider Company on this here podcast, one way or another. And I hope to do that recording in person. So thank you, a million thank yous to those folks. And then, wouldn't you know it, another person joined on the Cider Chat Patreon page. And this gentleman's name is Greg, and an email, just while I was getting ready to tell you all about this, came in from Greg. We were corresponding back and forth, and he wrote to me, "Hey Rhea, thank you for providing a vital means of discussion, dissemination of information, and a forum for community building as we all try to grow this movement into something that is sustainable and meaningful." Exactly, Greg. I mean, that's what Autumn was just talking about. We have to make it sustainable so that it's something that you go to when you're going to the party or going to a dinner, or you're just thinking, what am I going to have while I'm sitting out fishing today? I'm going to have cider. Nothing better than that. Greg goes on to write, "Whether it's cultural or social, movements historically often can point back to something that people could rally around. And I think Cider Chat is one of those touchstones." Oof. Man, I'm reading that for the first time, and that just hit me. Keep up the great work, and thank you for what you do. Best, Greg, and P.S. Congrats on your hitching, Mazel Tov. Oh, man, you brought a tear to my eye. And, I received that with deep gratitude, and I want to say that I know what's going on here. This is doing an archive of the oral history of cider at a moment in time like no other moment in time in the history of cider around the world. We're getting the voices of makers from all over the map, and to hear their voice and their passion and their triumphs and their tribulations going forward, there's nothing like it. And so I feel really honored to be able to do this task. And thanks for pointing that out, Greg. Means a lot to me. So to all you out there who are kind of hesitating, thinking, should I support this podcast? You know, there's cool people. Get on the Cider Chat train to Ciderville and help out this podcast. It's pretty much consuming all my time now. I'm trying to keep my other work together. But I'm segueing out of that and trying to just build up an infrastructure so I could get this to the point that we can really get it on the forefront so it is sustainable. So check out ciderchat.com, go to the Patreon piece there, or just Google Patreon, Patreon, Ciderchat, and we'll connect. Lots of great things I'm going to be now raffling off to the folks within there. I'm not going to raffle it off. I'm just going to pick somebody's name, and they're going to get one of those commissioned posters from Bonnie Doon Vineyard. That was Randall Graham. Okay, I needed a little break, and then we're going to be rolling out of here.
We're in Cider in Parkersee, Pennsylvania.
Ramborn Cider in the country of Luxembourg. Big Fish Cider Company in Monterey, Virginia.
Going up, going up, going up.
And all the good folks who have joined the Cider Chat, the Patreon page, are helping to bring this podcast to you. This is Rhea Windcaller, signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!